A sermon by Reverend Richard A. Rem, preached at Christ Community Church in Spring Lake, Michigan, August 15, 1982, entitled, The Grace That Enables Us to View Ourselves Honestly, in the series, What the Church Has Forgotten, AA Remembers. The texts for the sermon are Psalm 139, verses 23 and 24, and John 4, verse 29. Copyright Grand Valley State University.
And so at 6:15, when I looked at the clock, I realized it hadn't gone on, hadn't gone off. But then recognized that maybe it was the providence of God, for perhaps he knew that I needed an hour of sleep. For up until about 4:30 or 4:45, I had not yet slept, because as I was falling asleep, the silence was shattered with a telephone, which demonstrated the truth of what Thoreau said, that most men live lives of quiet desperation. On Monday evening, the phone rang another time, and it reported of a young man who entered this sanctuary in December. First time he'd been to church in years. In fact, throughout his 30 years, he really had not ever spent any time in church. He was amazed at what he heard and what he experienced. He came to see me a number of times over a period of months. I had a great fondness for him. He was so sincere. He was handsome. He gave the impression of deep seriousness. He asked the most pressing questions. He was searching for meaning. He was looking for God. Searching definitely, but able to hide what desperation must have been underneath. The phone call Monday evening reported to me that he had committed suicide last week. And so I think perhaps Thoreau was right, that most of us live lives of quiet desperation. Throughout this community today, there will be churches filled with people singing hymns and offering prayers and listening to sermons. People well-dressed and respectable, just like you and me. And we will greet one another, and we'll chat with one another, perhaps over a cup of coffee. And it will be a superficial meeting, majoring in trivialities. For in the church, we have lost what ought to be the very essence of that fellowship. That is, the honest sharing of who we are and where we're coming from, in order that our lives might be touched again by grace and supported by love. What the church has forgotten, AA remembers. And that fellowship of people scattered across the world has been and is responsible for the transformation of literally millions of people whose lives were broken and desperate. And human transformation is really what we are about as well. And yet, I'm afraid that human transformation is something that we talk about more than practice. We have the luxury of talking about it without practicing it concretely, such as AA does not have. Because the moment the recovering alcoholic forgets wherein lies his sanity, his health, and his wholeness, he is lost again. Whereas most of us can get by most of our days without ever letting anyone look inside, or maybe even acknowledging to ourselves the storm that rages within. We come to the fourth step in AA's program for the recovering alcoholic, the fourth step of 12. And it's a time of transition for us. The first three steps dealt with the human situation and God's remedy for that situation. In the first step, we admitted that our lives had become unmanageable. And in the second step, with some hopefulness, reached beyond ourselves to some power that might be there. The third step was a watershed step where we committed our lives, turned our lives over to the power of God, however we understood Him. In Christian terms, we had looked at the human situation, a situation described as misery. And we had looked at the grace of God that accepts us where we are when we turn to Him. But having put the person in relationship with God, having found rescue from that situation of desperation, where do we go from there? We come now with step four to AA's program of recovery. If I were to use biblical terms of our Christian tradition, it would be perhaps now entering into the area of sanctification or the way of holiness, which I would rather translate as the way to wholeness. Now we begin to deal with those principles of the AA program which parallel the biblical conception of the Christian life. The way in which one who has come into real contact with the power of God that changes life continues in the day by day and even moment by moment appropriation of that power of God in order to find the fullness of life. Step four indicates the necessity, calls imperatively for a fearless and honest moral inventory, an honest look at oneself, self-appraisal, an honest recognition and acknowledgement of who one is. Self-knowledge, terribly threatening, and yet also liberating. Step four recognizes that it is one thing to get an alcoholic sober. It is quite another to keep him sober. It is one thing to lay hold of the power of God to be rescued from a desperate situation. It is quite another to live in the constant appropriation of the power of God for the fullness of life, for health, and for wholeness. And as a first step on the way of life, the call is for a searching, fearless moral inventory, an analysis of where we have been, of where we are, and of where we are trying to go. And so, we come to step four and recognize that the alcoholic is not unique. He is made of the same fabric that we are all made of. There are some people who are so allergic to alcohol that its initial use will immediately cause a chemical reaction which will result in addiction. But most alcoholics are just like other people. They happen to choose a way of escape from reality which becomes self-destructive. The alcoholic is not unique in having problems. He is only unique in that the way he has tried to escape is a way that doesn't work. We all have our escapes. We all come to terms with life. We all find ways to cope. We all devise our own little systems of how we handle life with its hard realities. Some of us bite our fingernails. Some of us chain smoke. Some of us overeat. Some of us work too hard. Some of us play too hard. Some of us know it. Some of us don't. To know it is painful. To live not knowing it is pitiable. Step 4 calls all of us then to an honest appraisal, to self-understanding. And my thesis this morning is simply this: that it is the grace of God that enables us to take an honest look at ourselves. I believe that any honest self-appraisal must happen in the context of grace. It is the grace of God that frees us to look honestly at ourselves, to accept ourselves, and to take those steps that are necessary to modify that behavior that has been destructive for ourselves and all of our human relationships. And so let's look at self-knowledge for a moment this morning. The first thing I want to say to you is that self-knowledge takes courage. Now again, by self-knowledge, I mean an honest understanding of our own persons, the past which has shaped us, the present which conditions us, the future that sends its influence to determine us. By self-knowledge, I mean an honest appraisal of our strengths and our weaknesses, our good points and our bad points. Self-knowledge is the opposite of that charade that we're often tempted to live, where we excuse our behavior, blame others or circumstances, and rationalize who we are and what we have done with our lives, failing to take responsibility for ourselves. An honest self-appraisal is the first step toward health, because it is the beginning of a person coming to accept responsibility for his or her own behavior. The recognition that our fears and our anxieties, our deepest desires and our dreams, our feelings of resentment and being victimized, and all of those negative aspects of our personality have worked together to make us what we are and bring us where we find ourselves. Self-knowledge is an end to self-justification. Self-knowledge is the beginning of dealing honestly and in a sense of reality with our own lives. And that takes courage. AA is very, very serious about this business, for they recognize that for most people, alcohol has been an escape from problems that could not be borne. And once one becomes sober, one is not rid of the problems. We find that one does not have problems because one drinks, or overeats, or overworks, or bites their fingernails. One bites their fingernails, overworks, overeats, or drinks too much, because there are problems. And so if there's going to be any wholeness of human existence, those problems must be identified, they must be owned, and they must be dealt with. Self-knowledge takes courage, and it's a painful experience, because we have finally come to the point where we quit blaming everyone else and feeling sorry for ourselves because of our circumstances, and finally recognize that we do not have problems. We are the problem. Self-knowledge takes courage, and AA is very, very serious about that. One of the finest places of recovery for the alcoholic is in Hazleton, Minnesota. And they have a new four-step guide. It is an aid to taking the fourth step, the moral inventory. And they are so very serious about this that they begin immediately by saying three attitudes are important: to be searching, fearless, and moral. Are you searching? Are you really digging into your own self-awareness and describing your behavior as it really is? Are you fearless? It takes courage to face yourself in terms of what has really been going on in your life. And are you moral? Take a good look at the good, bad implications of your behavior. How does it size up with your own values? And then it goes on for some 30 pages and more with headings in bold print, a brief paragraph about those headings, and then all kinds of white space where you can do the writing. For example, false pride. What we mean is excessive pride. Being so thin-skinned that we have trouble admitting any human weaknesses at all. Another word for this kind of pride is grandiosity. Describe how your pride has kept you from looking at your own behavior. Well, there would be almost a sermon here on every page, but, for example, on being yourself. Today you're doing something important. You're being honest and responsible. At last, you're just being yourself. Doesn't it feel good? Are you giving yourself enough credit for this? Give yourself a pat on the back. How does your new feeling about yourself affect your relationship with others? Your turn. Begin to write. Or there is one here on self-pity. This is hard to recognize. And it's something no one likes to admit. It's a matter of feeling sorry for ourselves. Maybe because we feel people just don't understand us. Or maybe it's feeling that people don't respect us or don't love us enough. It means feeling hopeless. Feeling like a victim of circumstances. Have you ever felt self-pity? Do you feel sorry for yourself right now? Your turn. Right. And so on, page after page. Making it almost impossible for one finally to dodge one's own person. AA takes this so seriously and calls for such concrete action because it recognizes that this is the first step toward wholeness and the fullness of human existence. It takes courage. This step, I'm told, is often avoided. All kinds of reasons why one need not really go through this fearless, searching, moral inventory. But those who know it best say that unless one goes through this self-analysis with brutal honesty, one is not yet in a situation of security in the power of God. Self-knowledge takes courage. But I want to say a second thing about it. Self-knowledge is liberating. It's probably the most freeing exercise in the world. How much of our emotional energy is not expended in trying to keep up the front, keep the facade intact? We all play roles. There is our person, and then there is our personage, Paul Tournier says. Our person is one thing, and our personage is another. We project to the world the personage in order to protect the person. And how much of our energy is not expended in constantly playing that role, in wearing the mask, in living up to the expectations of those with whom we are associating at the moment. We go through life, as I began, with such superficiality, majoring in triviality, never really daring to let down our front, and simply relating in the depth of personal relationship. And so we meet, but we pass as ships in the night. And then, hopefully, at some time or other, we find that person, that one that can be trusted, that one who has communicated to us that total acceptance, that unconditional love. And in that context of trust, we're able to be ourselves. And it is a freeing and a liberating moment when we know we are accepted for who we are and not for all of the roles that we have played and failed at so miserably. When we know that we are loved and touched by grace so that we can relax and dare to look at ourselves as we are, knowing that we are accepted and will not be rejected, which I guess is one of our greatest fears. It's a liberating moment. Self-knowledge takes courage, but self-knowledge is freeing. And that brings me to that beautiful Old Testament lesson, Psalm 139. What a magnificent poem it is. Singing of the omniscience, the omnipresence, and the omnipotence of God. God knowing all things, God being everywhere, God holding in his hand with sovereign power the world and my life in a most intimate way. The psalmist, as he reflects on the wonder of God, the totality of his knowledge, of his presence and of his power, he is reminded of those who are the enemies of God, and he begins with an imprecation, calling down wrath upon the enemies of God, who are his enemies, I'm sure. And all at once he stops. Almost in the midst of the sentence, and he says, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. try me and know my ways, and lead me in the way everlasting. That kind of knowledge of oneself by the eternal God is the very foundation of an honest self-knowledge. But that kind of knowledge is a knowledge that can only happen in the context of grace. It was the psalmist who knew the God of the covenant. It was the psalmist who had been schooled in the ways of the eternal God, who had revealed himself to Moses and delivered Israel from Egypt, who was the God of grace, before whom the psalmist could open his life and could plead for transparency. Oh, how precious are thy thoughts to me. Self-knowledge is scary. Self-knowledge is painful. But the person that lives without self-knowledge is pitiable. For he never knows a moment when in the presence of the eternal God he can open his life and be absolutely and completely transparent. Does A.A. know God in that kind of gracious relationship? Not necessarily. For AA is not a religious institution, and it is allowed each person the right to define God as he will, and even to speak about what we have been speaking about here, these sins, character defects, maladjustments. They are very wise in not being very careful in definition. And a person who is recovering from alcoholism at step 4 may still be looking to some anonymous power. Where then comes the grace that enables honest self-knowledge? It comes through the group. It is certainly the grace of God, even though it is not named. But it is the grace of God which has encountered me in you, in my sponsor, in my friend, in the one who has put his arm around me and brought me to the meeting. That grace has come through one who has loved me unconditionally and accepted me as I was and saw some hope for me, saw me not as I was, but as I could be, as God would have me be, at all the potential with which he created me as his child. No, in AA, they may not at this point know the wonder of God's sovereign knowledge, gracious love, as the psalmist did. But grace is the context, nonetheless, grace mediated through another person, which frees me finally to be honest. And that brings me to the New Testament lesson. For what one recovering alcoholic will do for another is what Jesus did for the woman at the well. And that fascinating narrative which John put in that place for his own reasons, for his own structure of the gospel, I take only an aside from that story, but simply the relating of Jesus to the woman. Jesus, gracious Jesus, who was able to engage a woman of Samaria, every word is loaded, for him to talk to a woman, for him to talk to a Samaritan woman, all of that immediately spoke volumes, which he did not have to say in so many words. Jesus, gracious Jesus. reaching out to a woman living in quiet desperation, communicated to her the kind of grace that enabled her to come to self-knowledge. Interesting little story. Starting out at Jacob's well and a drink of water. Jesus moving directly to the point, bring your husband. I have no husband. You're right, you have no husband. You've had five husbands, and the one you're with now is not your husband. And she says, my, you must be a prophet. Let's talk about worship. But he had gotten to her. Not an unmasking that left her denuded, but a gracious peeling away of the facade that opened her up to the healing of his acceptance and unconditional love that enabled her to go back home. Say, come meet a man that told me everything that I ever did. Honesty can only happen in the context of grace. I wish the church could learn that. The church is the last place in the world you would want to be honest. A sinner wouldn't be caught dead in church. For the church is for the righteous, for the religious, for those that need no physician. But Jesus said, I came to call not the righteous, but sinners, sick people. People with problems, people with fears, with resentments, wallowing in self-pity, people with self-destructive tendencies, people who are poor bets and high risks, bleeding people, bruised people, people beaten in the game of life. I've come to help people say, that's who I am. And God loves me anyway. It is grace that enables us honestly to look at ourselves. And only then can we begin to move into the fullness of human existence toward health and wholeness.